Hello, and welcome to Lights Up on the Dark, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. Sitting on my right in New York is co-host Alexandra Gellner, aka Alex.
And sitting on my right in London is co-host Samantha Michka, aka Sam, or Dr. Sam.
Do you know what? Something I've noticed, people do always call me Dr. Sam when they find out I've got a PhD. It is never Dr. Michka, it's always Dr. Sam. And immediately in the conversation, right that second, oh, Dr. Sam. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is fair enough. Have you seen how many consonants there actually are in my surname?
Yeah, and I've learned just now, I've been pronouncing it wrong this whole time. But I feel like I've always introduced you, at least by email. Have I done your full name? Been like, Dr. Samantha Michka, or
yeah,
Dr. Michka. Actually. Yeah, well, you do have a PhD, and that's one of the reasons we're doing this.
This is true. You are an actor and educator, which is another reason why we are doing this podcast.
Yes, I do have an MFA. But, so I think we should say a bit more about our background so people know who they're listening to, who we are, why are we here.
They've pressed play now, so there is no going back, but, do you want to go first?
Sure, yeah. So, yes, as you mentioned, I am an actor and educator, I like to say teaching artist. I originally hail from California. I am now based in New York. And I moved to New York to go to drama school. I went to the New School for Drama, and there they really believe in training artists as also citizens, so they're not just, you know, making art for the sake of art, but, you know, really having strong messages with an eye towards, you know, social justice. So it really felt like kismet when I saw a listing, an opportunity to
combine my acting with my teaching artistry through an organization that offers educational shows about Anne Frank.
And that's ultimately how we got connected, but more on that later. How about you tell us a little bit more about you, Dr. Sam?
So from my side, I'm a Holocaust theatre historian. That's the PhD. And I specialise in English language Holocaust plays written from the 1930s up to the present day. I'm also a freelance Holocaust educator, so I teach about different aspects of Holocaust history to students and groups aged 10 plus. And one of the things that I really enjoy about that work in particular is, yes, we're teaching about the history, but it's teaching about the human aspect of that history. And also because my personal ethos is to teach about the past while trying to make things a bit better in the present, although the world is burning, I also work for a medical humanitarian charity. Should we explain a bit more about how this podcast came about?
Yeah, so it's been some time now. Do you want to... What do you remember about... You go first.
Well, let me tell you a story. Okay, so July 2021, it's the height of the pandemic, and I'm invited by Dr. Adara Goldberg of the Holocaust Resource Centre at Kane University to give an online session about Holocaust theatre. And I think we should also give a shout out and lots of gratitude to Adara, who is not only a lovely human, but essentially caused this origin story. So without her, it's likely this wouldn't be happening. So thank you, Adara. So I, like I said, July 2021, I give a session called So You Think You Know Anne Frank? Not realising that, of course, Adara has about a million connections. Enter you, Alex. As I remember it, we didn't get a chance to chat straight after the session, but my memory is that Adara introduced us via email and then we set up a call from there, I think.
I think so. I think also you might have reached out to the center, to the ED, and And they connected us because they saw, you know,
yep,
your credentials in theater and mine. So it's just like, oh, this seems like a natural pairing. And they were right. And we've really stayed in touch ever since, and really also discovered that our paths almost kind of crossed already in the past, but we just missed each other.
Yes.
So it's another reason this feels fated. You got your PhD at the University of Birmingham in the UK. That's where I spent my year abroad in undergrad.
We were so close.
So close, yet so far. Somehow we totally missed each other. But we stayed in touch ever since, you know, reconnecting through through King University, and we met in person a couple times. You managed to come over to New York, yeah. I managed to go over to London, and we both had ideas on working together more closely. You know, something got in the way. Usually it's distance, also other work, other commitments. And then a few months ago, you were like, hey, I've got an idea for a podcast. Do you fancy it? And here we are. So, you know, everyone and their mom was making a podcast during the pandemic, and we haven't stopped.
And then, yeah, and because I remember sort of that conversation with you and going, hey, because I'd been thinking about it for a while. And then when we were discussing ideas for what the first episode could be, given how we met and literally all of the related work we've done, surely it should be Anne Frank.
Yeah, I think that made the most sense. And, you know, so many people have said to us, you know, Anne Frank was what first got them interested in the Holocaust, so it just made sense that she's also what hopefully gets people interested in theater about the Holocaust.
So, before we get into it, ground rules.
Yes.
Okay, so, rule number one. Alex and I both work for separate organisations. You will have noticed that I have referred that I work for organisations but have deliberately not mentioned names. That's because this podcast is entirely on us. We do not represent the organisations we work for in our podcasting capacity. So if you don't like something you hear, it's on us. It's our thoughts and opinions based upon the research that we've done, and you can shout at us later.
Rule/disclaimer number two. Sam and I do use humor as a coping mechanism. Anyone who's worked in this field for any amount of time knows that you have to have a safety valve to release the pressure, or else, you know, you just go mad. You have to be a functioning human being. So, you know, it's going to be talking a lot about death and destruction, people doing horrific things to other people. So to cope, we do make jokes. We do laugh. We keep ourselves from going under, but we're in no way, in any sense, mocking the Holocaust.
No.
We are not mocking victims or survivors. We in no way intend to be disrespectful. Having said that, we do use dark humor, so just bear that in mind while listening.
And rule number three is the rule of engagement. We would love to hear from you. If you have questions about a play or an episode, something we've said, something we've covered, a suggestion for a play you'd like us to cover in a future episode, a correction for something we've said that's factually incorrect because, hey, we're only human, please do reach out to us and we'll give you the contact details at the end of the episode.
Okay, great. So shall we get into it?
Let's do it.
So, Sam, is The Diary of Anne Frank the first Holocaust play?
In some ways you could say that yes, it is the first Holocaust play. For example, you know, it's told from a victim's perspective and gets right into the sort of like the personal story. But on the flip side, there were what are classed as Holocaust plays and that I've seen spoken about in other books that cite them as Holocaust plays being staged in America as early as 1941. So, for example, you have Lee and Hellman's Watch on the Rhine, which was 1941. That is classed as a Holocaust play. You have a pageant that was written by Ben Hecht that was staged in 1943, I think, in Madison Square Garden, which is explicitly about the mass destruction of Europe's Jews. So I would say technically no. The Diary is not the first Holocaust play, but it is the most popular and it is the most widely known.
Mm-hmm.
So just to give you an idea of how, that's one of the first questions that I get asked after I get called Dr. Sam and the whole PhD thing, is they go, oh, what did you do your PhD in? And I say theatre about the Holocaust. And you see people's faces because they hear theatre and they think, oh, bright lights, like theatre, entertainment. And then they hear Holocaust. And there's a lot that people don't know how to react. And one of the top three questions I get asked without fail is, oh, is there any Holocaust theatre? I managed to fight back the urge to say, no, I have a PhD in something that's entirely made up. And then people kind of go, well, is there anything that I've heard of? Is there anything that, you know, what is a Holocaust play? And I usually say, The Diary of Anne Frank. And they go, oh, of course. Yeah. But one of the things that I like to use to show just how pervasive Holocaust theatre is without people being aware of it is to ask them, what are the last words in Anne Frank's diary? Now, you already know this, Alex, because you and I have worked together enough, and you have also been enough of my sessions where I do this. So you know that normally...
I think I do. I know what it's not.
What is it not, Alex?
It is not. I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart.
There you go.
It's not that.
So that is the number one
response.
It does
not end so rosy.
Exactly. That's what everybody... That's how everybody thinks the diary ends. And it's not. It's actually the way that the play ends in three of the adaptations that we're going to talk about today. The last entry that Anne makes in the diary is actually her talking about or wondering who she could be or what she could be if only there were no other people in the world.
Yeah.
And that is both so true and so depressing. That just goes to show how many people think that those are actually the final words of the diary. In spite of everything, I still believe that people are truly good at heart. And it's really not. That's the play, not the diary. And a lot of people are always massively surprised by that. And kind of, some people are almost offended.
I know.
And you're like...
It's like, I'm sorry that that's your memory and that's what's been in the zeitgeist, but we're here to remind you, no.
Yeah, just no.
Let's go back to the primary source, shall we? And that's...
But even then, you sort of talk about the primary source, and it's, you know, how many versions of the diary are there? Because, you know, when you think Otto Frank... I mean, I'm going to assume that everybody listening knows Anne's general story. And the fact that Otto, her father, was, you know, he was the only occupant of the secret annex who survived the Holocaust. He comes back to Amsterdam. He gets given the diary by Meet Gies, one of the family's helpers. And then I think it's in 1947, 1948, the first Dutch edition is published. But that was him editing the diary and the writing, and he was taking things out that he thought were too intimate. So a lot of the talk about, you know, menstruation and sexuality, he took out. Anything that he thought was too wrathful, you know, spoiler alert, Anne did not get on with her mother. So there's a lot of, you know, her slagging her mum off outright. So he took that out, as well as respect for the dead. But he, you know, so he still took a lot of things out. So even the first edition of the published diary is technically, yes, a primary source, but still very heavily edited by Otto.
Yes.
And then future versions and editions and material slowly got added back in over the years. But I think there's an institute in, I think it's the Institute for War Documentation in the Netherlands, and they finally released a book of, I think it's 3 or 4 different versions of the diary, but all together, so you can actually see this is what it was originally, and how it's been chopped and changed, and where things have been moved around. So I don't like using the word tragic, but at the same time, I think that's one of the things that's most tragic about Anne's story, is that she did not get a chance to really put her voice across.
Right.
It's her words that are used, but it's other voices that are speaking. It's also not just in the versions of the diary that are published, but also in the plays. Because it seems that everyone, in the nicest way possible, but everyone who's adapted the play, to a certain extent, has kind of gone, oh no, I'm speaking the way that Anne would have wanted.
So which adaptation, because you mentioned there, we're going to be talking about 3.
4.
Four. Oh four. My god, we're talking about 4 adaptations of The Tyrant, right? There's so many out there, people. That's why we started this podcast. And you know what? It's not just The Diary of Anne Frank. We're just using this as a jumping off point.
Oh yes, and spoiler alert, this is why the episode is called All the Anne Franks. Although technically we're lying, because we are not going to cover all the Anne Franks. Because that would just be
there's
marathon.
So many.
There's so many. Well, there's the one that you represent Anne in performance, don't you?
Yes, we do a solo show, but that the whole script is directly from the definitive edition version of her diary, like what we believe that at least the publishers feel like would have been the version that Anne would have put out, because it's not the edited one that albeit we do take excerpts from that from the diary and present it. Activate the text, bring it alive for students. So it's a solo show about Anne. And sadly, we do end with, like, one of the last bits is, I still believe in spite of everything that people are truly good at art. It's not the last line. I'm sorry.
But do you
there
put it in its context?
A version in this context, yes. I do, there is a version, that, but that's for the kids. That's for, like, introduction.
Okay.
To,
yeah.
Introducing kids to the Holocaust is, you know, introducing them to the voice and story of someone who's close to their age. So it just eases them in without, you know, really traumatizing them. I do have a dream of doing another solo show adapting her text to the stage, where we do end with "Let me be myself. And I'll be satisfied if only, you know, there were no other people in the world."
I mean, I'm not saying that if a producer is listening and would like to fund Dr. Sam, the playwright, and Alex, the actor. I'm just saying we got, you know, there's options, there's possibilities.
What's the first Anne that you want to cover?
Keep things simple. I think it's easier to do it in chronological order. So the very first adaptation of the diary takes place thanks to a guy called Meyer Levin, and he was a second generation Eastern European Jewish immigrant. He was a writer, he was a journalist, but always kind of struggled with his Jewish identity. And then he worked as a battle correspondent and during the Second World War, and travelled across Europe with the advancing American forces. And so, for example, he was not there at the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, but was able to go there soon after it was liberated. And obviously, later down the line, he realised the horrific irony of that, which is that he had been in the place where Anne had died. You know, this was probably the most research-intensive chapter, so I actually flew to the States and visited the Meyer Levin archives at Boston University and went back through reams of, like, letters and telegraphs and telegrams and things that he had sent reporting on what he'd seen. And his words are incredibly vivid, and he talks about seeing, you know, walking skeletons on the road and, you know, with glittering eyes, and we realise that these are men, we realise these are the last Jews of Europe. And he writes in such a way that you know he's not, I mean, how can you be okay?
Mm.
You know, he's seeing these things as someone who is also conflicted about his Jewish identity. He is then walking through or travelling through the wasteland of immediate post-war Europe and seeing what's been done to the Jews.
Please keep talking. I viewed this as, you know, basically, I know you said co-host, but I think you're basically Conan O'Brien. I'm going to be your Andy Richter the whole time. Just FYI.
Okay, this works. This works. Okay. So Maya Levin is traveling across Europe. He is deeply affected by what he's seen. And he kind of takes back what he's seen. He sort of carries it with him, very unsurprisingly. And takes it back with him to the States and becomes obsessed with the Holocaust and the notion of telling the story. He knows that someday a teller would arise from amongst themselves. So he was married to a French writer called Teresca Torres, and I exchanged correspondence with her, and she gave me permission to access some of the materials at Boston University that otherwise I would not have been able to access. And unfortunately, she passed away a few years ago. But she knew how obsessed. So then in 1950, she got hold of a copy of the Diary of Anne Frank, and she'd heard things about it. I think it was in French. And she gave it to him. And he read it. And again, he says, quote, he fell in love with it. Tereska would later, she wrote a book, and I think it's unpublished, called The Haunted Houses of Maya Levin, and she actually sent me a copy, and in it she recalls at one point they were in the middle of a really bitter argument, and she ended up saying to him, it's Anne Frank or me. And that's the extent of his obsession and how much he wanted to tell the story. But that would come many years down the line. What happens is Maya reads the diary, is electrified, and is like, right, this is it. This is the story. This story has to be told. So he writes to Otto Frank, and is talking about reviewing the book and is talking about turning it into a play or a film. And Otto is reluctant, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, because in his eyes it's eight people living in a cooped up space in silence for hours. How are you going to make a film or a play about that? But Levin ultimately convinces him and says, look, you know, let's try it, let's do it. And then I think it's 1952, Levin wrote a review in the New York Times Review of Books, and praised the book to the skies. Did not necessarily declare a possible conflict of interest, but just said, you know, this book is amazing, everyone should read it. And the publishers for the English language version in America had initially done a print run of 5,000. By the end of the day of Levin's review, all 5,000 had sold out, and they were rushing a print job of 15,000 through. And all of the, you know, producers, directors, film studios are all descending on the publisher, Doubleday, demanding to know, who do we contact about the options and the rights and all this kind of thing. Maya Levin is over the moon because, you know, Anne's story is going to be told, and he can also help tell that story. He's going to write a play. So he does, and he writes a first draft, and sends it to a producer called Cheryl Crawford, and she reads it and says, okay, not bad, could do with some changes, but, you know, let's see. So Levin starts to redraft, and then that's when things start to fall apart, because Cheryl Crawford was, I mean, you and I both know, and anyone who goes to the theatre knows, that theatre is so subjective. And there can just be something about a play, whether you're watching it or it's in the text, and you just go, I can't tell you why, I can't put my finger on it, but it doesn't sit right, it doesn't work. And this is what she says to Levin about his play. She's essentially like, I can only go by my own judgment. It's all I have, and it's not, it's just not right. It's not working. So Levin is getting increasingly desperate. So he starts trying to persuade Otto, you know, actually maybe Cheryl Crawford should not be your producer. And Otto's like, well, no, she, you know, she's very highly regarded on Broadway, and I think we should give her a chance. But Levin keeps pushing, and Otto keeps pushing back. And all through this process, Maya Levin has been really clear that he wants to make it a Jewish play, and it's about the Jewish people, whereas Otto has said, no, 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 it's not, you know, and he talks about the book in Europe as being read more widely by Gentiles. It's influenced by, you know, Jewishness, but it's not, you know, don't make a Jewish play out of it. To which the argument is by, you know, several scholars have pointed out, well, of course it was read more by Gentiles than Jews because there were so few Jews left in Europe to read it. But Levin sort of says to Otto, okay, yeah, no, fine, I won't make a Jewish play out of it, or just kind of goes, oh, okay, yeah, no. And then this kind of tussle starts, and then Cheryl Crawford backs out of the project altogether for reasons that are still a little bit unclear, but she just, I think she could probably see which way the wind was blowing. And know that, you know, and again, you know, as an actor, when someone is very fixed in their ways in the rehearsal room and is not going to change and is not going to work with you, it's not conducive to a productive production, shall we say.
No, this doesn't seem collaborative.
So then ultimately the back and forth begins, and Otto is starting to lose confidence in Maya as, you know, the person to adapt the play and to write the play. So then Maya in desperation says, okay, well look, let me send it to a list of producers that you have approved, and if they don't like it, then I won't adapt, I'll withdraw, fully expecting that he'll find a producer who likes his play. Well, dear reader, he does not find a producer who likes his play. They all turn around and say, no, sorry. However, the sort of, because he had, I think he had signed an agreement that said he would drop it if he couldn't find that producer, so he has to drop it, but he can't drop it. He can't let it go. And then he starts to get really vitriolic towards Otto. So he starts to read in the, he reads a report in the press that a non-Jewish writer is being considered to adapt, and he writes this furious letter to Otto saying, I won't stand for this, I will write about it wherever I can. He starts putting full page ads in newspapers challenging people to come and see a staged reading of his play and to judge which they think is better. You know, the one that he's done or the one that is going to be done by here enter Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett. So again, this is sort of like in the early 50s, I think it's 1952, 1953 by this point. And they are a husband and wife duo who are, they write musicals and comedies for the big screen. Their most famous film they wrote was It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
That was them. Yeah. So they are social pluralists. They're known to be very liberal. They're known to be very universal. Ultimately, these are the folks who are recruited to write the diary. Levin's furious because they're, like, as far as he's concerned, the complete opposite to whoever should be adapting the diary for the stage. And he really goes all out. He starts writing to rabbis. Like I said, he's putting adverts in the press. He even, and this is the thing where my, this is the bit where my kind of sympathy for him does waver, is when he even questions in correspondence if Otto survived Auschwitz at the cost of his family's lives.
Right.
And kind of sacrificed them to save himself.
Yeah.
And
It's like, so, what are you doing, guy?
Yeah, you're like, nobody is going to be sympathetic towards you now.
Not a good look.
It's not a good look. No. So, the Goodrich and Hackett version goes ahead, and I believe, I can't remember if it's 1954, 1955 that it premieres in New York. And the play goes on to win a Tony, it goes on to win a Pulitzer, it's getting all the accolades, rave reviews, you know, everyone is going mad about it. And Levin is kind of left, sitting in the dust, furious, heartbroken, helpless. And like I said, you can feel for him to a certain extent. I mean, he even ended up taking Otto to court, and Goodrich and Hackett. He tried to sue them for plagiarism.
Oh my god.
Because you kind of go, well, you're working from the same text, so of course there are things that are going to be very similar.
Uh-huh.
But hey. And that,
wow.
I think, yeah, that ultimately got settled out of court. But he never lived to see his play performed in the United States. So it was performed, I think he did a lot of work on it, and then it was performed in 1967 in Israel by a group of Israeli soldiers. And I think he was told to cease and desist. I think word got back to Otto and Goodrich and Hackett, and they were like, you know, you can't be doing this.
Yeah.
And then he died in 1981. Mm-hmm. And his play was performed, I believe, in 1983. And then again in 1991. To the best of my knowledge, that has been it. So he never saw it stage. And the real kicker is that it's not actually a bad play.
Really?
I mean, copies of it are incredibly rare and incredibly expensive. So I managed to track one down from a bookseller in Los Angeles online, and this was in 2010, and I think it cost me about $230.
Oh my gosh.
And I think it's actually a facsimile. I don't even think it's an original copy.
Yeah. So where do you think, because, you know, you said that the producers were like, eh, it's okay. Where do you think, you know, he was missing the mark with them? What do you think wasn't appealing to them?
See, that's the really difficult, that's the thing, is that I just don't know. Because the version that I have, which was published in 1967... I haven't been able to find a complete version of the play from like any of the first drafts. So it's
that makes sense.
Literally impossible at this point to say what it was. I mean, I don't know if it was the staging, the stagecraft, the wording, you know, if he's a writer, he's a novelist, was a novelist.
Right.
So, you know, he knew how to draw characters, but you know, maybe it was something to do with his writing style. Maybe he was going too preachy and trying to, you know, make it too didactic. I don't know. Genuinely couldn't say.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to, you know, because he said, like, oh, come see my play and, you know, see how it compares to this. Maybe there was some aspect of also, like, the Goodrich and Hackett, you know, just... there's that feel-good, you know, universal themes that's a little, you know, a little rosier, does end with the whole, we are, you know, in spite of everything, we're all truly good at heart.
Yeah.
That probably just appealed more to the masses and a population that was like, okay, it was horrible, let's please move on.
Exactly.
Because we don't want to sit with this.
Exactly.
It's making us uncomfortable.
Exactly. And yeah, and that ties back exactly into like the experiences of Holocaust survivors as a whole. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort of came back from the camps and went, this is what happened. And everyone, especially in Europe, kind of went, yeah, we know, we get it, everyone suffered. Now we just have to move on, life goes on, like kind of get over it. So that's why you don't see, you know, Holocaust theatre and testimonies and interest in the survivors and what they survived sort of really coming through into public consciousness until about the 60s, 70s, because everyone was basically too busy going, okay, yeah, no, we get it, and you look awful, and yeah, we can see the tattoo on your arm, and yeah, we know, but everyone suffered, like, you know, London got blitzed, and yeah. Coventry got wiped off the map, and, you know, other country, you know, all these countries were invaded, and, you know, we're all trying to rebuild, and you just kind of think about what was lost.
It seems like after, so there was the Diary of Anne Frank, it was like, on Broadway and the movie, and it was like, great, okay, we've processed this, we're all good now. And then the miniseries Holocaust with the one and only Meryl Streep feels like that's what really got it back, you know, got the discussion started again about, hey, let's remember this happened and also make sure it never happens again.
Yeah,
see, I'm curious to see how, like, you know, when, if there were, because, you know, as we both know, there's so many Holocaust plays, you know, what was the production of Holocaust plays after the Diary of Anne Frank?
To be discussed.
Maybe this is
episodes.
Another episode. Yeah. Oh my God. All right, so there's the Meyer Levin saga, which in itself feels like its own play,
it is for another episode. the story, like, just the whole, it is such a tragic story. Like, Levin's story is tragic because he lost himself, and he was so desperate to, you know, he was so affected by what he'd seen that he wanted to tell the world, and in trying to tell the world, he just lost himself. And that is really, really tragic.
This brings us to the whole, you know, what we wanted to talk about was just what's the responsibility as, you know, playwrights and actors in sharing these stories on stage, and how do we approach it?
Ugh, no
and
pressure.
Not lose ourselves like Meyer did, but
well, I think that's the, so this is where I bring in some of sort of the key theories from my PhD research. So my PhD thesis had the very catchy title Empathy Effects Towards an Understanding of Empathy in British and American Holocaust Plays. Super catchy, just trips off the tongue.
Love it.
It's
5,000 copies.
Five, do it, buy two, one for each side of the bed. But sort of the key things, the key sort of concepts that I look at in that research, especially in relation to Anne Frank and Maya Levin, is this notion of kind of projection around empathy, and sort of a better understanding of empathy, what it is and what it means, and how it can be good, but also how it can be incredibly problematic. So this is just a reminder that all of the sources will be in the show notes, so if you want to go and look up the different concepts and sort of where I've, you know, the different practitioners and theorists that I've, you know, sort of drawn from. The two key things, firstly, what, Alex, what is your understanding of empathy? And I say to you, what is empathy? You immediately say,
I think immediately just putting yourself in someone else's shoes.
Right.
So feeling as if you are that person, feeling, I mean, and of course, I'm going to sound like a total actor. feel good, flowery language. But no, for me, it's, you know, truly feeling, viscerally feeling somebody else's feelings.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what a lot of people, you know, it's walking a mile in somebody else's shoes, right? Mm-hmm. So the key distinction, first of all, is that sympathy is feeling for someone. So you're almost experiencing a feeling literally for someone. And we usually express sympathy in the context of something sad, you know, so somebody has died, we right. feel sad, we express sympathy. So we're feeling sadness for the person that we're expressing the sympathy to. But mm-hmm. with empathy, it's more a case of feeling with someone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a alongside. We're not placing ourselves in front of them. We're feeling mm-hmm. it with them.
Yeah.
And this is very, very basic. But then you also have what is called empathic projection and advisory projection. So if you have ever said to a friend who is going through a particular situation, if I were you, I would do X.
Mm-hmm.
That's advisory projection, because what you're giving advice, essentially. You're saying, if I were you, I would do this. This is what I'm advising you to do. And what you are doing is you are bestowing your own thoughts, your beliefs, your viewpoints on that person's situation. So you're seeing their situation, but from your own perspective and your point of view and what you would do. Empathic projection is the one that I think comes most closely to what you said, which is where you look at a situation that somebody is going through and you try and see it through their eyes,
mm-hmm.
from their perspective, from their viewpoint. Is it possible to achieve perfect empathy or perfect empathic projection? I'm going to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Because to a certain extent, we're all influenced by our own beliefs, our own experiences, our own viewpoints. You can't escape it. You know, we hear all this talk about
right.
unconscious bias and prejudice and so on and so forth. You can be aware of it, but I would argue, and people may shoot me down for this, but I would argue it's never truly possible to see something through somebody else's eyes
mm-hmm.
entirely. So what we see with My 11, for example, with the play and his adaptation, is it kind of starts out with this kind of mix of kind of 50-50, I would say, empathic advisory. Like he's also Jewish, you know, he's had difficulties with his Jewish identity, and expresses similar difficulties in the diary, so on and so forth. But then he loses a really critical part of empathy as well, which is self-other differentiation, which is basically knowing where you end and the other person begins.
Right.
So when Otto Frank, Cheryl Crawford, you know, everybody involved in the adaptation turned around and said to him, sorry, no, you can't work on the adaptation anymore, he is on record as saying that both his and Anne's Jewish voices were being stifled.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't take it as being just against him. He also took it as oppression of Anne. So he lost that self-other differentiation. I think that's why it became such an obsession with him, why he wasn't able to let go, is because in his
mm-hmm.
mind, he and Anne were the same.
Right.
So I think, circling massively back around to what you were saying about the responsibility and of artists and writers and performers and how this kind of material should be approached and what we should be doing with it or should not be doing with it, I think it's worth bearing in mind empathy, what it means, what are we projecting as the writer,
mm-hmm.
as the actor, as the director, as the reader, as the audience member. What are we projecting onto it? What are we getting from it? Where can we see ourselves reflected? Where do we not see ourselves reflected? And just always keeping that in mind. And for me, obviously, the most crucial thing about Holocaust theatre is some kind of call to action.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, which sounds really simple and a bit trite and a bit soundbitey, but I think if you're staging the Holocaust, there should be encoded in there somewhere. Not slapping
yeah.
the audience around the face and going, this is now what you need to go and do, but some kind of call to action.
Yeah.
Because it's no good learning about the past and going, oh, wasn't that awful, if there's not going to be something that changes in the present.
Right. And that can be a process. That doesn't have to be...
Exactly.
You know, and keeping in mind, like, this is, you know, again, it's not a sprint. It's a marathon. Just let's keep talking about it and practicing radical, I guess, you know, compassion and,
yeah,
you know, remembering to be, you know, hear and listen. Not like, you know, listening in order and waiting for your turn to talk, but like truly listening and sitting with it and being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah, definitely.
Which, you know, feels like, you know, I think Anne Frank, the Goodrich and Hackett, feels that production felt like, you know, it had a nice, you know, bow, just, you know, where Otto was sitting with the diary, right? Is that how the Goodrich and Hackett one ends?
It begins with him in the annex. I think it begins with him in the annex with Meep, and then they find the diary and he picks it up and starts to read.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's kind of like this, yeah, flashback.
Yeah. But then it was later adapted by Wendy
Kesselman? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And in that adaptation, it feels like she injected a bit more of Anne Frank's Jewish identity.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Goodrich and Hackett version, I mean, listen.
It's a long one.
It's really interesting what you said about this is a marathon, not a sprint, and it's a process, and sort of that call to action, because that is so true of, in the context of Holocaust theatre, you cannot go and see one play, or even 10 plays about the Holocaust, and have that as a standalone education about the Holocaust, or have that as like your sole source of learning about the Holocaust. It's incredibly helpful because it takes, you know, you can't conceptualize 6 million Jewish dead in your head. You just can't imagine those numbers. When you bring it down from that level to the personal, which I think is also one of the reasons why the diary is so popular, and because there are, even in the midst of this Jewish teenager's diary, if you go back and read the diary, there's some, who, tell me somebody who has not fallen out with their mum. Tell me someone who is not jealous of their older sister, you know, or has, you know, boy troubles, or, you know, gets into trouble at school, or, you know, there's all these kind of like relatable, empathic moments within it. So I think that's the beauty of Holocaust theatre. It brings it down from the macro to the micro, and then we can reach out and we can touch upon that. But the whole kind of issue with the Goodrich and Hackett play is that it's very sentimental, and it really romanticizes Anne.
Right.
And what you get is this sense of, because her dad was instrumental in talking to them. He went back to the annex with Goodrich and Hackett, and they actually went and visited it together. And, you know, Frances Goodrich wrote about it in her diary, and, you know, was talking about how affected she was. And you can't help but feel, if you read the diary and you know that broader context, when you read the play or you see the play, you're looking at the Anne that Otto has idealized, his baby girl that he lost. And there's things, you know, like, the first time we see her, she starts taking her underwear off in front of a room full of adults, because obviously she's put on all of the clothes because she can't pack a suitcase, but then she sort of strolls in and then is undressing and takes off a pair of knickers, or sorry, as you would call them, panties.
Panties.
And she takes off this pair of ladies' bloomers. And her mother is like, "Ham, what are you doing?" She's like, "All right, I've got other pairs on." And then she just keeps taking this underwear. And the Anne of the diary, just, I think I'm relatively confident in saying no. She would not have felt comfortable. No. She'd have at least gone into another room away from the adults and might have done it in front of her sister, but there's no way she'd have done, especially in front of, like, you know, Peter and Mr. Van Dan and her dad. Just no.
Yeah. So no. She liked her privacy from what, and again, you know, being conscious of, like, this is how I would see it. Maybe I'm projecting a little bit for myself or my own understanding, my own interpretation and portrayal of Anne, you know, here, but that she, you know, really valued her privacy, you know, wouldn't let anyone read it, trusted her father enough to keep it safe. And yes, she was a chatterbox and she knew how to speak her mind, but I don't think she was, you know.
Yeah, she wouldn't have been pulling that kind
bold
of...
bold like that, no.
Yeah.
I think it was an exhibitionist about
it. Like, so you can see, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would see, like, an 8-year-old doing or a 9-year-old doing. Because they wouldn't have, but you know, she's just turned 13.
By the time you're 13, you're like, don't look at me.
Yeah, you're like, I don't know where to put my limbs. I feel like I'm taking up too much space, but I don't know where my space is. Yeah.
Don't look at me, but please listen to me. Don't shush me.
Yeah. Yeah, that, So with the Goodrich and Hackett one, I think I feel like I'm going to say this a lot in relation to a lot of the plays that we talk about, but I think it's worth working with it. I don't like to say using, because that just doesn't sound right. Working with the play with context. So if you're going to read it in class or you're going to get your students to do a production of it, it's really worth letting them have that context of, you know, did you know her dad edited this diary? Do you know there's multiple versions of this diary? Do you know how much of the things that she talked about were taboo at the time of the first publishing, like menstruation? Like, what? Yeah, that's why the diary became so popular in Japan, was because it was one of the first books that dealt with menstruation.
Oh.
And teenage girls were going, oh my God, this is...
We can talk about this now?
We can talk about this now.
Oh, thank God.
So... Yeah. So I think just sort of having that context and working with the play and the diary to sort of have that informed bigger picture, and just always reiterating to students that Anne Frank was not the only victim.
Mm-hmm.
And also things like country context, you know, the Netherlands were different from France, were different from Germany, were different from Belgium, you know.
Yeah.
When you look at Holocaust history, there was no one mass killing policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, up until 1940-1941 there was no plan to mass murder the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why all the stories of survival are different, because depending on who was in charge of which area in Nazi occupied Europe, you either had the ones who were diehard anti-Semites,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, were just the worst of the worst, and others who, yeah, they were all Nazis, but weren't necessarily as concerned about, you know, killing Jews and making areas Judenfrei, than their counterparts. So that's why the stories can of survival and what happened can vary so wildly across Europe.
Right.
So I think, you know, again, with Holocaust theatre, it helps to represent that sort of wide ranges of experience.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, you know, Anne Frank, but, you know, sort of without sounding too flippant, other Holocaust victims are available.
Yeah.
You know,
that's always the message I try to leave students with. I'm like, this is just one story.
Yeah.
Yeah. That we have lost.
Exactly. Yeah.
The future of which we have lost 6 million.
Yeah. And also, and again, another massive segue, but you look at the diary of Etty Hillesum, who was a young woman in her, I think she was in her early mid-20s. She was living in Amsterdam. She was Jewish. She was there at exactly the same time as Anne Frank.
Mm-hmm.
But so few people know about her, because she was, you know, a fully grown woman who had multiple love affairs, sexual affairs, you know, talked about sex in her diary, talked about relationships, talked about what was going on, and yet very little relatively speaking, when compared to, say, Anne Frank, is known in public consciousness about her.
Right.
But again, another story for another time, because there is a stage adaptation of The Diary of Etty Hillesum.
We'll cover that.
Another time.
I just have trouble with, it's I'm glad, schools do teach the diary, but they usually just teach it as the play, though.
Ugh.
You're seeing less and less, and, schools devoting the time to read the whole diary.
Mm.
And I'm grateful to have, theater as this entry point to really, study this material and this part of history, but where I'm hesitant to just be, telling Anne's story is, I'm hesitant because then I just so often see people's education of the Holocaust starting with Anne Frank, but also stopping there.
Mm.
So that's why I always want to end with, like, there are other stories, and then, then I do myself and others a disservice by not having, a list of names, but then we get very, overwhelmed by just the sheer number.
But can I flip that back to
do
you
it.
In a different way? So this is going to sound so pretentious, but my really strong belief is that as educators, it's our job to kind of crack the window open a little bit to let some of the light in,
mm-hmm.
and to give the students, however old they are, whatever demographic they are, the space to think things through for themselves,
mm-hmm.
and to ask questions and to work things out for themselves and process it and go, huh. So if you're saying to them, there are other Holocaust victims, survivors, stories that you can learn about. Sure, we may not have a list of names immediately off the top of our heads. We may have a few. We may go, okay, for example, Primo Levi,
mm-hmm.
Or Etty Hillesum, or, Mary Berg. But if we're saying to them, go and find out, go and look, go and see, and they go online, for example, and type in Holocaust survivor stories and hit enter, oh my God, they're going to find so much.
Mm.
So I think giving them that space to work through and to ask the questions, and to also make it really, really clear to them, if nothing else, that they should never stop asking questions.
Mm.
Because I think that is also, for me, one of the fundamental things about having that call to action. History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And I look at the world today and what's happening, especially in US politics at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, I just think to myself, we've got to keep teaching our children to not stop asking the questions, to be critical thinkers, to be critical citizens, to kind of go, hey, I'm not sure about this. And it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum, whether they're hearing from the Democrats or the Republicans in the US, whether they're hearing from the Tories or the Labour Party in the UK, whoever they're hearing from, always be questioning that agenda and what is this person telling me, and is this okay, and am I okay with this? So I think, and it comes back into what we were saying about it being a process,
mm-hmm.
and because as well with Holocaust theatre, you're kind of plugging in a bit to human emotion.
Mm.
And also one of the, as part of that, the thing I love about theatre as well is that it can also work incredibly well for non-traditional learners.
Mm.
So if you've got students who have additional needs, or who, for example, struggle with reading, or whatever their background, however they learn, whatever helps them to learn, what's it like for them if we implement some stagecraft techniques,
yeah,
and look at the diary through that? Okay, so let's find out the dimensions of the secret annex, let's use masking tape in on the floor of the school gym and measure out how big the rooms were, and then let's all try and move around within those spaces and put chairs and tables and things in and try and get a sense of what it would have been like to be eight people trying to move around in that space. You know, if you've got students who are incredibly good at research or who enjoy that aspect of things, let's go and look up, you know, sound effects. Let's go see if we can find out, you know, what the call-up notice that Margot receives, you know, near the beginning of the diary, near the beginning of the play. Mm-hmm. What was a call-up notice? What did that look at? And then straight away, you've got your dramaturgs, you've got your researchers in place. So you already, you know, there's a theatre role for them. You've got your lighting, you've got your sound. What are the kind mm-hmm. of sound effects? What are some of the challenges that we could get around creatively? How are we going to represent Mushi the cat on stage?
Mm.
How do you get a cat on stage? Because in at least two of the adaptations, they bring on a basket and a lot of fuss is made about a cat.
And you hear some meowing.
And you might hear some meowing, but yeah. how do we do that? And then you can sort of, you know, get your students to be thinking about, you know, creative solutions and sort of just opening things up. Costume. You know, mm-hmm. so when Anne talks about, you know, her mother's corset snapped, Margot's bra's getting too small, the family comb only has three teeth left in it. You know, so what were the fashions of that day? How many items of each piece of clothing would you need with sort of like the progressed aging to show that, you know, it's okay, this is 1940, okay, this is 6 months later, okay, now this is 1941. They're wearing, do you leave it or how do you age it, you know? So I think just sort of getting students to sort of think more creatively whilst at the same time engaging them with that learning,
yeah.
And just being able to just sort of crack the window a little bit, just to let that light in and to give them that space for those questions to start to form, for that process to start to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then as educators, parents, teachers, you know, it takes a village, being able to guide them and help support them with answering those questions, finding the answers to those questions, asking them questions in return.
Yeah, there's multiple entry points. That's great. That didn't sound pretentious at all. Now, also, I want to remember, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. I need to put that on a cross stitch.
Yeah, I'll have one as well.
Sam Michiko.
Can you?
Yeah.
Attribute that to me. I can't remember where I read it, but I read it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it stuck with me.
It's good.
So, Sam, can we talk about your favorite adaptation of Anne Frank's diary?
Your favorite. I mean, yeah, who are we kidding? It is. It was written by a Dutch couple, forgive my pronunciation of the names, I'm doing my best, Jessica Derlecher and Leon de Winter. If I'm saying that wrong, any Dutch speakers who are listening, please get in touch and let me know how to pronounce it properly. But it is the only version or only adaptation of the diary that was written using all of Anne's writings. I saw it twice in Amsterdam, actually, and, you know, just was blown away by it each time, because it actually begins in Bergen-Belsen, but there's no, like, exactly, so you know, there's like this soundscape of, you know, a faint sound of the wind, and it's Margot and Anne whispering to each other. And then it moves from Bergen-Belsen into post-war Paris. Incidentally, you know, the set, when I saw it at Theatre Amsterdam, was built according to the exact dimensions of the secret annex of the Franks' flat where they lived before the war. So everything was built to scale and they were moving up and down. So it was like literally someone had picked up the annex and put it on stage. They were going up and down ladders, up and down the stairs,
exactly
as they would have done. It was so, so good. And then it begins in post-war Paris, and Anne is meeting her friends, and then she sort of says, oh, you know, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to have something to eat. I'm really, really hungry, in this cafe. And then there's a man at a table nearby, and they start talking, and he says, oh, I heard you say that you're a writer. And she says, oh, yeah, but I've written a diary, but I would only show it to the one that I love. And he said, well, I'm a publisher, I'd love to read it. And then this conversation starts, and then the rest of the story is then told, or the narrative is then told in flashback, and going back to Amsterdam and moving, you recognize like really key points from the diary. And then at moments in the play, Anne steps out of the action and goes to talk to the publisher, who, you know, appears on stage at different points as sort of like this referent point for the audience. And if something needs to be made clearer or, you know, whatever, he's there. And then as the time progresses, spoiler alert, so if you don't want to know who he is, skip ahead like 15 seconds. It then turns out that he's Peter, or Peter Schiff, who was Anne's first love. And she talks about him in the diary, but everybody focuses on Peter Van Dan as sort of like, oh, you know, she was in the annex with him, and they have this like really intense relationship, and but people overlook Peter Schiff.
I know.
Right, so then he's there, and you're just kind of like, oh my God, like this. And it ends on railway tracks, and you don't know where. And you don't know if it's sunrise or sunset, but it's like, and the railway tracks are actually online, on the stage. And it's like, there's a hint of like forest or something. And Anne is walking along the railway track, or she comes out and she says, I always dreamed that. I always believed that. I always thought that. But she never says what she thought or she believed or dreamed or anything. And then she turns and kind of walks away from the audience along these railway tracks, like she's balancing on them, you know, like kids do when they're sort of balancing on a balancing beam. And then
Oh.
the rest of the cast are there as well. And there's a moment of complete silence, and then hundreds of pages just flutter from the top and just
Wow.
cover the stage. And then it just sort of, as I recall, it just sort of ends with like the rest of the cast sort of in the shadows, but you can still see them dotted around, and then like the spotlight on her that just very, very slowly fades. I was a wreck. It's
Oh my
one
God,
of
I
the.
would be too. It's just you
Oh
describing those, like that last moment. I'm just like, oh my God, I'm gonna
But it's
cry.
just so good, and you have these moments where, you know, you don't dislike, but you know. She's not a simple, straightforward, uncomplicated girl. She's this teenager, and she's navigating these difficult relationships. And there's points in the play where people laugh, in sort of like her interactions with her and her dad, because it's, you know, and with her mum, because it's, you really get that sense of the empathy and everyone going, oh yeah, this is me. Oh yeah, I can definitely empathize. Yeah, we've all been there. We've all done this. And it was just so well done. And the tensions in the annex were really well done, and it felt like you were genuinely watching this unfold. And even though you knew what was coming, it was still devastating. And then at the end, when they talked about, they actually, within the play, there's that moment where they acknowledge the identity of the publisher and say, yeah, he didn't make it either. And you know, let's look at who Anne would have been, because obviously in the diary she talks about, I'd love to travel to Paris and study fashion and things like that. So just these tiny moments that they had taken from the diary and then used them to build just, I mean, honestly, for me, it is like the closest we come to a genuine representation of Anne Frank as she was. And I, you know, I mentioned it earlier. I talk about it in a book chapter that I wrote on adaptation, and I'll the sources will be in the show notes. So, but it's called "Have We Found Anne Frank? A Critical Analysis of Theatre Amsterdam's Anne," and I just talk about the whole thing, and it's so well done, genuinely well done. And you know, I am notorious for being really tight with my standing ovations. I'm not just kind of like, oh, they did really well. But that play is one of maybe two, three plays about the Holocaust that I've seen where I've been on my feet at the end and just gone, yes, unequivocal.
Oh my gosh.
Brief side note. It was really freaky because the little anecdote for you. So when I went to Amsterdam to see the play the first time, I literally went out there just to see the play. So I was in Amsterdam for like 24 hours. So I flew out there, got the train into the central station, stepped outside the station, and immediately bumped into someone because I was looking around, wasn't paying attention to where I was going. And I looked up to say, oh, you know, sorry. And found myself staring at Otto Frank and was like, am I hallucinating here? What is this? And he just sort of looked at me and he sort of gave me this very slight smile and sort of, you know, sort of like tipped his head and then just walked away. And I was like, that's, I'm seeing things, like, you know, it's just, it's like association. What is it? And yeah, I got to the theatre that night and then the actor stepped out onto the stage and I was like, that's the guy that I bumped into at the central station this afternoon. Wow. Just like, I'm not going crazy. I'm not seeing Otto Frank wherever I go. It actually was that guy. So.
Wow, that sounds like also a very, God, I wish I could have seen that, see that production. It's, that feels like, it seems like a once in a lifetime sort of production. I mean, with the way that you talk about, it's their Marie de Plaine and their the Prince of Rock's addresses to scale. Like, I would have, well, what a dream to be in that production, to also see that production. That also sounds like a really also responsible, because you hear so many of these plays, there's just so many plays out there or books out there that are just like imaginations of, okay, what if Anne Frank survived? What would she be doing?
Mm.
But it sounds like this production does a really responsible version of that, where it presents it as this could have been, but we don't get it. We don't get to have that. We don't get to have that ending. Just the way that you describe those closing moments of like, I thought that, I wish that, and you don't hear the end of it because we don't get to hear the finishing of her thoughts. We don't have even her any diary entries after, you know, August of 1944, because
she didn't have her diary anymore. Yeah,
we don't get to have it.
And you know,
we can't have nice things.
We can't. Well, this is a thing as well, because coming back to sort of what we talked about earlier with, you know, I truly believe that people are good at heart, and I can't remember who it was who said it or wrote it, but somebody said, I really doubt that Anne Frank would still have been believing in the goodness of people at heart when she was dying of typhus in Bergen-Belsen.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, okay, yep, sure.
I mean, I know I've said that. That's why I refuse to. maybe, but I don't know. Who knows where I've, like, I heard it, first heard it. I thought it was from you. it's the reason I don't, want to end the show that I travel with, that tells the story of Anne Frank. I don't want it to end with that line. But we do for the solo show, but for the other show, you know, some people are like, why don't you have that line? I'm just like, because it's not, this is for a more grown-up audience, and I think they can handle a not tidy ending.
Well, that's the thing as well. I mean, I think this is maybe a conversation for us to have in a future episode, but that emphasis on there being, like you say, some kind of uplift or some kind of somehow quote-unquote redemptive ending, like all of this happened, but let's look at the hope and the resilience, and in some, you know, pieces and areas, that's completely the takeaway that we should get from it, but I do wonder to what extent that is starting to become a bit of a buzzword, just in terms of, you know, this uplift and, you know, the not a happy ending, but you know, something that goes, oh, there's hope, because how do you find hope in mass murder?
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely a conversation for a future episode, I think.
Yeah, for sure. But, so which version do you recommend teachers bring into their classroom to teach?
Yeah, well,
help them teach the Holocaust.
The first disclaimer is that, unfortunately, to the best of my knowledge, the Delacour and De Winter adaptation is only available in Dutch. And in fact, when it was performed in Dutch, and you got given an iPad. It was so cool. With a simultaneous translation playing at the same time. So when I went to watch it, I sat with earbuds in and had one earbud in so I could understand what they were saying and the other one out so that I could hear the inflections of the actors. So I have a copy of the play, but it's only available in Dutch, far as I know. If anyone wants to start a campaign to get it published in English, please loop me in, because I think it should be. I really think it should be. Like, if it existed, I would far and away be recommending it and saying work with this one, because it's so rich with the situations and the telling, and you can open it up to have discussions around, you know, what was, you know, which resources were used and where can we tell in the diary. You know, there are so many, you could easily teach a whole year class on it. However, we don't have that, so I would say, I think it's down to preference, because I know what I think, but other people will disagree with me, so I'm not at any point going to turn around and go, you should be using this, with some exceptions. I think the updated version by Wendy Kesselman, so it was kind of her readaptation of Goodrich and Hackett's version, I would say, because it's still not perfect. There's still that element of sentimentality and a little bit of romanticism, but it's better, I think, than the original Goodrich and Hackett version. And I think, again, coming back to what you were saying, and you and I have always said, is, you know, working with the players a springboard to then go off and look at the lives and the situations and the experiences of the, you know, because in the play they're characters, but they're real people. And you know, some of the points that we've touched upon, and in terms of, you know, sort of the dramaturgy and the research and the actual physical aspect of theatre and set and costume and those kinds of things. But I think as well, bringing in whichever version of the play is worked with, I don't like to say used, I always like to say worked with,
yeah.
Whichever version you work with, bring in some of those questions around who's mediating Anne's story, which version of Anne's story are we hearing? Because then from that, you can also start to broaden it out into themes that I think we're going to keep coming back to in this podcast, which is what happens when we work with Holocaust testimony and adapt it in any way. You know, what happens if we fictionalize elements? What does that mean in terms of Holocaust denial? What does that mean in terms of Holocaust revisionism? What does that mean in terms of, you know, the very unsuspecting but, you know, enthusiastic generation of English teachers that set The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas as a text because they thought that, oh, it's about the Holocaust, so we're teaching kids about the Holocaust, but there was no contextual historical teaching. So you've got a generation of school kids who think that The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which is a novel, is somehow based in fact. So you can work with the play as a starting point to then go off in so many different avenues, and that's why, even though, you know, it's a play, you can work with it in citizenship or social studies or English language or drama or religious studies, because there's so many different lenses that you can look at it through and so many different questions that you can ask and answer. And I think that's the key thing, is that as long as questions are being asked, and there's going to be difficult questions, there's going to be challenging questions, but the important thing is that they're being asked and they're being addressed and we're thinking about them.
Yeah, and I feel like in an ideal world, you would get to study the play, and because you don't have time to go through all of her diary, you're studying the play in tandem with the excerpts that they're drawn from, that some of the moments in the play are drawn from.
Right, and you know, there's also things like one of the questions I would love to explore if I was working with a class is in the Goodrich and Hackett and the Castleman adaptations, Mr. Van Dan steals some bread. That never happened.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen. And it was an invention of Goodrich and Hackett to add some more drama to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of the you know, resources that I've read about featuring that element, you know, people have said that, you know, Otto was very uncomfortable with that because he felt that he was sort of slandering his dead friend and that it wasn't okay, and but for whatever reason it stayed in. But as you and I both know, it's not in the diary, it didn't happen, but the person that Anne did complain about as a food hoarder was Dussel, and she talks about, you know, it's disgraceful, you know, we found oranges and chocolate in his cupboard. You know, it's awful that he's, you know, hoarding these things when one of the helpers, you know, needs oranges for his sick stomach. How dare he?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever talks about the fact, like, Anne, what are you doing snooping through the other guy's cupboard? What? And so there's that whole, but that whole thing of, you know, well, when the play was written, Mr. Van Dan was dead. And, you know, this was put in there and it was represented as him stealing food out of the mouths of children, including his own son, and all the drama around that. How do students feel about that? How do teachers feel about that? Is that right? Is that wrong? What are the ethical questions? So again, just sort of looking at those aspects. And I think just getting students to think about things in a new way, and to keep asking those questions and to kind of go, oh, sure, I'm being presented, especially with Holocaust films and, you know, the, like the prevalence of like films and media and novels that are coming out all the time. Just getting them to go, okay, what am I being told? Yes, this is a good story. Do I need to take it with a grain of salt? Is everything in this true? What am I learning from this? What do I need to go and check for myself?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we covered a lot for a first episode, just because this is also, I mean, it is one of the more popular documents that we have from this time that's been adapted time and time again. So I hope this gives a lot of students and educators you know, something to think about, think about,
some springboards for conversations, and and obviously if you're listening and you have any questions, queries, comments, let us know. You know, we as we said at the top of the episode, we'd love to hear from you, to get your feedback. The contact details are in the show notes. And yeah, that's
okay.
That's all from us for today.
And do we have a sign off?
We don't.
I guess, I don't know. Would you like people not, to walk away
can
with?
Can we just be really clear that we are not going and scene, because that's so inappropriate.
No, I think just, I want to just say, like, I guess just take care of each other.
Take care of yourselves and each other. Jerry. Yeah.
Wait, that's from something.
It's from Jerry Springer. That's the thing.
Oh, we're not doing that.
Exactly. That's why I was like, Jerry. I was like, no.
No, we're not doing that. Okay. So,
be good to each other, just... and we'll be good to each other, be kind, and we'll see you again next time.
Yeah. See you next time.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.